The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to our Friday Space Show. I am your host, David Livingston. Great to be here. Thank you all for tuning in. Another really beautiful day in the San Francisco Bay Area. So I hope wherever you are listening to this show, it is equally as nice. A couple of announcements and then into our program. For those of you able to access and use the toll-free number today, it is 1-866-687-7223. And we certainly welcome your phone calls. For those of you needing to do email, it is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, @thespaceshow.com. And our website, thespaceshow.com, does have a detailed, comprehensive newsletter on it. You can't miss it. So that newsletter has a listing of all the current shows and their guest bios. And also, it's the only place where we have a future events section. So if we do need to modify the schedule any week, and that does happen, you're going to find it first on our website newsletter. From there, you can subscribe to our very short email newsletter that goes out early Monday morning, California time, by email. 1 or 2 lines about the week's programs that won't clutter up your inbox. If you would like to receive it, please send a note to Dr. Space at thespaceshow.com. And then all of our programs going back to 2001 are available as archives. You can listen right off of our website, or you can download the programs without much trouble. If you need help on that, please let me know. On our website, you'll see a Space Show gear store, which is up in the left-hand corner. Please do check it out. Probably, to me, the most important button is the Support the Space Show button, because we are a nonprofit 501c3 with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. And we are on the air and delivering the content of these programs free of charge, plus our webinars, because many of you do support us, and we certainly appreciate that support. If you do have any questions, please check out the OneGiantLeapFoundation.org website, or drop me an email at drspace@thespaceshow.com. We are trademarked and copyrighted, and you can freely distribute these programs to people you think have an interest in space or you think should have an interest in space. There are only a few restrictions. Don't do anything commercial. No private edits, like for a YouTube channel or even for your own website. If you want to put cuts up or something like that, we don't permit that, other than for the guest. And then also, we don't allow written transcripts. We don't have permission from our guests to do that. And even if these transcripts are for your own use, please don't do it. And other than that, please enjoy the programs. And if you have any questions, don't hesitate to get a hold of me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. We're podcasting, and you can find our RSS URL on our website and both of our newsletters. If you have any questions about our podcast, please do get a hold of me. We're in iTunes, Microsoft Zune, and a host of other places around the net. Then also do remember, we are partially sponsored and brought to you by the Secure World Foundation. They promote cooperative solutions for space security. You can get much more information from their own website, which is swfound.org, and they do sponsor our webinar series. And that brings me to our program today. For those of you that frequently listen to The Space Show, you know that I have been talking to various contributing authors for an excellent book, Starship Century, Toward the Grandest Horizon, and today is no exception. It's a pleasure to bring to The Space Show for the first time Dr. John Kramer. He is professor emeritus in physics at the University of Washington in Seattle. He is an experimental physicist who approaches theoretical physics from an experimentalist viewpoint. He has published more than 200 physics research papers in peer-reviewed physics journals. He has written hard sci-fi articles and books, and he is the author of two published novels, Twister and Einstein's Bridge. John is also a science writer and writes a bi-monthly science fact column, The Alternate View, for Analog Science Fiction and Fact magazine. He has written more than 160 columns, all of which are available on the web, and he contributed to Starship Century with a chapter, Exotic Technologies for Interstellar Travel. Dr. Kramer, welcome to The Space Show. How are you today?
I'm fine. Thank you very much.
Are we close to any exotic technologies? And can we look forward to this soon, or are we still looking really far ahead?
I'm afraid we're not very close. The problem is that all of them require at least one visit from the Tooth Fairy, and those are sort of rare and few and far between. So,
boy, not among many of the space people I talk to. They think the Tooth Fairy is real, but that's another show for another time. Well, let me rephrase it. Are we making sufficient progress? Is there enough R&D or just research going on where someone my age, I'm 67, assuming I keep my mental facilities as I age and live to a ripe old age, will I see at least really notable advancement over the next 30 years?
Well, I guess I would have to say that the progress has to be first in the sort of theoretical domain. There's not a whole lot of sort of hardware testing and so forth, because the problems are fairly hard. You first of all have to understand some things that we don't presently understand very well. A lot of these are in the area of general relativity and its interface with quantum mechanics. There's a theory out there someplace that we don't have a very good command of called quantum gravity, which is a hypothetical theory that would unite quantum mechanics and gravity. And we know the name of that theory, but we don't know very much else about it. And people are working very hard trying to figure out some way of putting quantum mechanics and general relativity together. So far there's not a whole lot of progress. General relativity opens some interesting doors, and the question is whether quantum mechanics is going to slam them in our face when we truly understand how it gets there. We don't know how to make wormholes. We know general relativity tells us that wormholes and warp drives are in principle possible, but quantum mechanics may be the showstopper that prevents those things from actually being real phenomena.
So how do you find that out? Is it by research on theories, or is it by doing experiments, or what's the process?
Two pieces of laboratory experiments that are going on right now. One of them at NASA Houston, where there's a test with an interferometer trying to see whether you can perturb a light beam going around an interferometer by storing energy in a certain kind of capacitor. And as far as I know, they have negative results so far. The other is work done by James Woodward in California. And he has some ideas about the relationship between inertia and Mach's principle that in principle could lead to some very interesting new developments. But at present, it's something that, if at best, generates thrusts on the order of micronewtons, and so it's not very, it's not something you're going to go to the stars with anytime soon.
He's been on the show a couple of times, and
So you probably already heard a lot about his work. So.
I have heard quite a bit about his work. So, are more and more people, and is more and more money flowing into the research, or is this a pretty esoteric, limited field right now?
Well, I would say that there seems to be some people that have money that are considering whether they want to make significant investments. But as far as I know, that there are not any new big commitments or for doing some kind of a push. And maybe, as I said, a lot of the progress that needs to be done is on the theoretical side, and so maybe it's not time to do such a push until the theories are better in hand. As I said, the problem is that general relativity tells us about these exotic kinds of things that we would be interested in having available, wormholes and warp drives, but they require very strong curvature of space in a way that we don't know how to do. It takes a lot of mass energy to bend space even a little bit, and these require fairly dramatic changes in the way space is structured, and so I think it's going to be a long time before we have anything resembling a wormhole or a warp drive to use for interstellar travel.
So if this is where we are, I guess somebody might say, why put time and energy and research into this? Maybe we ought to be focusing on the nearer types of things, like we can't even really get back to the moon now. So maybe we should be focusing on the baby steps.
There's no technological reason we can't get back to the moon. It's strictly political reasons. It's expensive, and nobody has the political will at the moment, at least in the United States, to go back to the moon. And so we can't do it, but there's no technology in the way. In these other things, it's a question of technology. The more you learn, the more you're able to do, and people are trying to learn more in these areas as a prelude to actually doing something.
When you have students in classes or others have students in classes, do these far-out possibilities attract students, or do they see it as probably not in my lifetime, let me work on something closer in, like the next iPhone?
The students I've been teaching are mainly since I retired. The University of Washington has a 40% rehire thing, and so I've been teaching one class one quarter a year of a couple of hundred students, and I have been awarded the honor of teaching the non-physics majors, the chemistry, the health science and biology majors, and people like that, the non-calculus physics. And these people are very interested in these far-out ideas. They'd rather hear about those than about Newton's laws and so forth that we're trying to get through their head. But they're not likely to make any contributions except maybe financially eventually.
This is science light, right? It's not for the serious scientists.
It's not that different. The stuff we do is not that different from the other track, which is for physics majors, but it's a little bit different, and it sort of avoids calculus and wherever possible, and has more lectures per week in order to get the ideas across.
The Starship 100-year program, which DARPA sponsored.
Yes.
If you could, since we're looking into the future, if you looked into the future for 100 years, where would we be in your estimation? Are we funding and things like that stay relatively stable? And I know that's a huge assumption, but in 100 years, do you think a lot of these issues will be resolved and challenges will be resolved?
Yeah, I'm sure things will be different in 100 years. And what way, it's hard to say. I mean, one cannot predict breakthroughs, and we obviously need some important breakthroughs if we're ever going to go to the stars. It's hard, as you pointed out earlier, it's hard enough to get to the moon. It's many orders of magnitude harder to get to the stars. There is a barrier in that human beings don't respond well to being in zero gravity for a long time, and human beings don't respond well to being bombarded with ionizing radiation. And having a starship that takes on the order of 100 years, during which you would have zero gravity, or perhaps zero gravity, and perhaps be bombarded with ionizing radiation all the time, is rather daunting. And there's no fast way of doing it. We don't have a drive that could allow us to travel to the stars with a ship that would accelerate for 1G in the direction of the star halfway, and then turn around and accelerate 1G back and to slow down. And even if you did, it would take a very long time. So it's a really, really hard problem. That and the thing that came out of the Starship 100-year Starship program is to sort of emphasize to people like me exactly how hard it is, that people wave their hands and say something about using nuclear rockets or something like that. Even those are not good enough to do the job as far as getting to the stars. And that's the reason why exotic technologies are particularly interesting, because they might conceivably provide an alternative that makes the whole problem a lot easier.
In your chapter, you use some terms, punctuated equilibrium, basket diversification. Can you talk a little bit about that and what you mean?
Yeah, well, I started off my chapter by talking about what a precarious situation we actually live in. As I said in the beginning of the chapter, I live in Seattle, and when I first moved here, I saw this big mountain on the horizon, and I said, gee, it's really nice that Seattle has Mount Rainier. We're dominating the landscape. And somebody said, well, you know, Mount Rainier is really a dormant volcano. It erupts every 5,000 years. And I said, really? How long ago was the last eruption? And they smiled and said 5,000 years ago. And so, you know, we in Seattle, we're living in a somewhat precarious situation, because if that volcano or a couple of others in their neighborhood ever erupt, life is going to change rather dramatically around here. We also know that we live in a solar system which is configured so that big rocks occasionally fall from the sky, and one of them killed the dinosaur 65 million years ago, and there were various other events that happened that in which most of the life on Earth is extinguished. And this could happen again. The asteroid belt has many, many big rocks in it, and there are certain zones in the asteroid belt called the Kirkwood zones that are sort of blank spots. And the reason is because those are regions where if a rock is in the asteroid is in that orbit, it's in a resonance with Jupiter that in a fairly short period of time kicks it out of the asteroid belt and sends it someplace else. And someplace else is often the inner solar system. So our solar system is sort of configured to have a shotgun that periodically sends large asteroids in our vicinity. And we've been here fairly successfully for a while with no big asteroid hits, but this is not going to last forever. And so all of our resources, culture, our education, our knowledge, our art, are all in this pretty blue basket, and the solar system's throwing rocks at it. And so we really need to diversify. We need to have significant populations on other parts of the solar system, and preferably on Earth-like planets someplace else. And so we need to diversify and avoid the possibility that that some unpleasant event could wipe out everything.
The efforts, I mean, this is not part of your chapter, but the efforts ongoing by many to figure out ways to mitigate an asteroid impact. If something big were coming in, are you optimistic that within some sort of a time frame, 50 years?
Well, I've seen these movies about how that they made a while back about dealing with asteroid hits, and they're very unrealistic, because they sort of fix the problem at the last minute, and that's not the way it would have to be done. You'd have to know long in advance that there was an asteroid that was on a collision course with the Earth, and while it was far away out of in the outer reaches of the solar system, you'd have to modify its orbit out there, because once it's heading directly for the Earth and will hit in a couple of days, it's way too late. You can't change its velocity enough to have any significant change. And if you blow it up, you change a rifle into a shotgun, and you still have the same problem, that you have a lot of hits instead of one, but it's not really that doesn't change the impact scenario very significantly. So mitigating problems with asteroids is a difficult problem, and it's very difficult if you only find out that it's a problem at the last minute.
Well, yeah, they all say they need years and years of warning.
Yes.
Other than for Bruce Willis, but
right.
You have an email question from Alan, who is in Houston, Texas, and Alan says, given the long times involved for accomplishing anything, in order to keep people interested and to show that progress can be made, what are the kinds of inspiring baby steps that should be worked on by scientists today and that should receive funding? We don't want to lose the audience for this because it's going to take so long to accomplish.
Yeah, that's a very good question, and I wish I had a better answer for it than I'm likely to give. But anyway, my feeling is that the problem is mainly theoretical. And I think that there are a few promising leads. And as I said, the one needs to have much better understanding of these exotic solutions of general relativity. So there needs to be some concerted effort to try to decide whether there's been a little bit, but whether there. I guess you could say you can divide general relativists into two classes. One of those are interested in working out the details of wormholes and white warp drives, Alcabert, Matt Visser, and company. And there are others who think that there's something wrong with general relativity, that there needs to be a sort of a picket fence erected so that the solutions that they approve of are in the allowed domain, and the exotic ones that seem to allow one to do things like going faster than the speed of light or backwards in time are banished to the outer regions because that's the region where you shouldn't go. And there have been some attempts to sort of develop principles and techniques for excluding various parts of general relativity from consideration because they fall outside of certain kinds of energy conditions and so forth. As far as I know, most of these things have failed. And furthermore, they're based on, in many cases, on using quantum field theory to apply to general relativity. And the problem with that is that quantum field theory, the part of quantum field theory that's making these predictions is the same part of quantum field theory that predicts that the cosmological constant should be 10 to the 54th times bigger than it actually is from astronomical measurements. And so it's that part of quantum field theory, as far as I'm concerned, is not to be trusted. And so even if it said things about general relativity, it wouldn't be something worth considering. So I would say that there needs to be a lot more investigation of the theoretical aspects of general relativity as it applies to these things that would be of interest for star travel, like wormholes and warp drives. Also, we really need a way of getting places without using rockets. The idea that the only way of moving forward in space is by shooting high velocity mass out the back is a killer. You're not going to be able to go very far under those circumstances. And if there was some way of getting around Newton's third law of motion, or the law of conservation of momentum, that would go a long way to solving the problem. And that's the reason I mentioned James Woodward, that he has a tentative solution to this problem, and it may turn out to be important. It may go away, but it's certainly something that's interesting to pursue.
I don't know if you watched the latest launch from Wallops with Orbital's rocket, which is supposed to dock with the space station Sunday morning.
I heard about it, but I didn't watch it.
So, I mean, it's just like any other rocket launch, except
that it's a private contract.
Yeah, a private contract, and it's right on the water. But it's really neat to see the rockets go, but there certainly needs to be something else if something else is possible. And I guess that is the big question: is something else really feasible or possible other than rockets or throwing thrust out the back end?
Yeah. Well, when I was in high school, I invented a space drive. It was made with flywheel, unstable flywheels that spun around in various ways. And the idea was that If you have an unstable flywheel, it produces a force up and then a force down, and if you turn it over while it's going up and then down, then it will go up and then up and lift you off the ground like your bootstraps. It turns out that it doesn't work, of course, I was a junior in college studying physics before I could do the calculations that would indicate why it wouldn't work, and that was an interesting exercise. People are always inventing space drives and patenting them in one thing or another, and in general they don't work. But it would be nice if at least one of these days we come along and find one that does work, and maybe Mach's principle is relevant and will help solve the problem, or maybe not. But that's at least one straw that's presently being grasped at.
A lot of these people self-publish books, and I receive them in advance of their wanting to be a guest on the show to tell us about their theories of everything and their unique flying saucers and approach to what they're doing.
Yeah, I get some of those too.
Interesting. You have Sarah is in Portland, Oregon, and she says, given what you're talking about, do you believe that settling space and having communities in space can ever happen on an interstellar level, or would we be damn fortunate if we could even do it on some place like Mars?
Well, there's certainly a mechanism that you can imagine by which you do have space settlements on stars, which involves robots and genetic and massive genetic engineering. You basically send machines to the stars that have the biological wherewithal to recreate human beings when they get there. And that's certainly something that's, as far as I know, there's no showstoppers that would prevent that kind of thing from happening. As far as people getting in a spaceship and flying to another star, that presently looks exceedingly difficult. But in my chapter in the Starship Century book, I outline one way. Given the existence of wormholes, one way in which one might do that, and that's to take a wormhole mouth, reduce it to the size of a small particle, give it the charge to mass ratio of a proton, accelerate it in something like the Large Hadron Collider to a Lorentz factor of 7,000 or so, and send it to the star, and then manipulate it when it gets there to stop and allow you to step through. Using that technique, we could get to the stars in a few weeks, but we don't have wormholes to try it out at the moment. No.
Todd is in San Diego and sent in a question. Does confirmation of Higgs boson impact any of this?
The Higgs boson's confirmation is, I guess you could say, it was good news and bad news. The good news is that the standard model, which predicted the existence of the Higgs boson, and it was fairly accurate in predicting about the mass range it would have, turns out to be pretty good. The problem is that the standard model turns out to be pretty good, and the standard model is a kludge. It's made up of about 20 or 30 arbitrary parameters, the interaction strengths of the various things, the masses of various things, and so forth. And we have no idea how these parameters got set or where they came from or what they are. And what we really need to do is break the standard model and find out what's behind it. There must be a better theory of particle theory someplace. And what one really hopes will come out of the LHC is not one result after another that confirms the standard model, but some new and unexpected result which shows a flaw in the standard model that allows us to get at what's behind it. There, for example, beyond the standard model, there are these predictions of supersymmetric particles, and if one finds any of those using the Large Hadron Collider at CERN, then that would be a lot more important a result than the Higgs boson. Let me say a little bit more about the Higgs boson. The Higgs boson is a hypothetical particle that gives mass to many of the other particles. Interestingly enough, the mass that it gives to other particles has very little to do with our everyday lives, because while it gives mass to the electron, it does not give mass to the proton. The proton is made up of three quarks that are very light, and the Higgs boson gives them their mass. But most of the mass of the proton is made because the three quarks are confined to a very small volume, and they bounce around like crazy inside the volume, and the mass energy of their bouncing around is responsible for most of the mass that protons and neutrons have. So everyday matter, the mass of everyday matter, is more a result of the Fermi motion of confining quarks and or particles and nuclei than it is in anything that has to do with the Higgs boson.
So it's probably not going to be a help to interstellar travel and space settlement out there.
To put it this way, this is money in the bank, so to speak. The better we understand nature, the more we're able to do. And the Higgs boson discovery is a significant achievement in our gaining better understanding of nature. But the application of quantum chromodynamics, which is the area that sort of mainly impacted by the Higgs boson on interstellar travel, is pretty peripheral at the moment. It could later on turn out to be very important, but at the moment, we're not going to make a rocket by shooting Higgs bosons out the back or anything like that. So it doesn't have any direct relevance, unfortunately. It would be nice if it did.
You're being switched by a listener to your science fiction work, and he says, what prompted you to begin writing science fiction, and what do you do with your science fiction? Is it all based on real science, and you go into the future as if we already have these technologies you've been talking about, or is it something different? I haven't yet read your sci-fi, but I'm interested in doing so.
Okay, well, let me talk a little bit about that. I'm always glad to talk about my book. In 1980, many years ago, I was the chairman of a committee for the Division of Nuclear Physics of the American Physical Society called the Nuclear Science Resources Committee, and the committee was responsible for going around to the congressional offices and talking to congressmen and their staff members and so forth about the importance of doing basic research in general and doing nuclear physics research in particular. And what I learned was that most of these guys who were the congressional staff members in the congressman's offices who were making most of the decisions having to do with the funding of science were lawyers who had just gotten out of law school and were spending a year or so as a congressional staff member before they got a high-paying job. And they the last science they had was in junior high school or something. So I decided that it was worth my while to, first of all, take along with me a sheet of paper describing some nifty piece of science, and secondly, learn how to write such nifty pieces of paper. And so I started writing science fact articles, and I sold a number of them to Analog. And then in 1984, Stan Schmidt, Stan Schmidt, said that Jerry Parnell, who had been writing the Alternate View column, had decided he was making more money writing about computer hardware, and so there was an opening for a columnist, and would I be willing to take it on and write science fact articles on a regular basis for Analog? And this was a soapbox that was too good to pass up, so I decided to do it. And I was a little scared of being able to write something sensible every other issue of Analog, but I managed to do it so far. Anyhow, so over a period of time, I therefore wrote a lot of science, and I got the feeling that I was only telling half the story, because I was telling the results, but I wasn't telling very well how it felt to do the science, how the people in the laboratory were actually behaving, how they were reacting, and so forth. And, you know, in most science, most of the sort of popular science fiction on TV and so forth, the scientist is usually some guy in a white coat who makes highfalutin pronouncements that always turn out to be right, and that's not really the way it works in the laboratory. You make lots of mistakes, and there's a lot of trial and error, and a lot of a lot of humor about things that work and things that don't work, and so forth. So I decided it would be valuable to drop the other shoe and write a science fiction novel describing the doing of science as accurately as I could. And I was encouraged in this by a book editor, David Hartwell, who said, it was told me that there was not enough hard science fiction being written, and I was somebody who could do it, and I should try. So I did, and I sat down and wrote Twister, which is set at the University of Washington and is about a rather conventional condensed matter experiment that turns out to have the unexpected effect of changing normal matter into shadow matter and shadow matter into normal matter, and greatly to the surprise of the people who were investigating it. And it ends up projecting a protagonist and two small children onto an alternate Earth that has six-legged animals, and they have all the laboratory equipment, no electric power, and on the other end they have electric power and no laboratory equipment, and so they have trouble getting back, but they managed to do it in the end. And that was my first novel, Twister. It did relatively well. It earned out its advance four or five times. It had a British edition and a Japanese edition and various others. And I was going on to write a second novel, which was at the time the superconducting super collider was being constructed in Waxahachie, Texas. And my wife and I went to Waxahachie, Texas, and talked to a lot of people who were involved in the project. And I was busily writing a novel. It was 80% completed, and then the United States Congress, in their wisdom, canceled the project. And my science fiction novel said that the superconducting super collider had been projected into an alternate universe. So I was the novel was sort of sat there dead in the water for a couple of years. And then when I was on sabbatical in Munich a couple of years later, I had the bright idea of changing it into a time travel novel. And so the final book, protagonists are working at the super colliders. Something terrible happens, and two of the protagonists go back in time and manipulate the Reagan, Bush, and Clinton administrations in order to get the project canceled to avoid the disaster. And so that's Einstein's Bridge. And the Einstein's Bridge in question is a wormhole. Wormholes used to be called Einstein-Rosen bridges before John Wheeler decided to call them wormholes. My science fiction novels were both intended to sort of portray as accurately as possible how science is done. And as far as the accuracy of the science, when you're writing science fiction, it's sort of like grafting an upper flowering plant onto some sturdy roots. There's a graft between the real science and the rubber science, and it's up to the author to make the graft as invisible as possible so that the reader goes from the science that's presently available to the science that's being extrapolated in the fiction without realizing that that's what's going on. And so both of my books have appendices where I confess to where the rubber science comes in appropriate places.
I remember when they canceled the super collider in Texas, and I lived in Oklahoma at the time, and people were really upset about it. But do you think the science results would have been any different had it been done in Texas?
I think the Higgs boson would have been discovered 10 years earlier. The chances of finding something unexpected that I was referring to pretty much scale with energy. So the super collider would have been, I forget exactly the number, but two or three times higher in energy than the LHC. And that increases the chances of finding the Higgs boson, which is not really relevant at the moment because it's been found. But it also increases the probability that you might find something more interesting and more exotic than the Higgs. So I think, and it also destroyed the careers of a generation of particle experimentalists who were about to go to work at the superconducting super collider and suddenly found themselves out of a job. In fact, I think a lot of the trouble on Wall Street has resulted from the fact that a lot of the very brightest computer jocks that were working on the superconducting super collider found jobs in the finance world and invented things like these derivative products and so forth that have caused so much problems in our economy lately. I think you can attribute that to the, at some level, to the cancellation of the superconducting super collider.
I'm to take that seriously, right? Because I've never thought about that before. You know, I've gone and talked to staffers about various space policies, and I imagine the people who really pushed for the cancellation of this were the very lawyers and types of people that you described a few minutes ago.
Well, some of them were. I mean, there were always people who think that we have to balance the budget, and that's more important than anything else. And these were the guys who were seeing that the budget was out of balance, something had to be done, and here was a project that had been estimated at $6 billion that seemed to be heading for $12 billion, that as far as they were concerned was out of control and needed to be terminated. The reason it started at 6 and went to 12, as I outline in part of the book, is that there was a preliminary design that decided that the aperture of the superconducting magnets should be a certain size. And when they began to do serious calculations and simulations, they realized that that size was too small and they had to make the aperture bigger, which meant that the magnetic field was made weaker, which meant that you needed more magnets, which meant et cetera, et cetera. And so it cascaded and raised the price of the thing. It was not something that was a result of bad management. It was a result of a calculation about how to make the machine work properly. And it's really unfortunate that it got canceled. The space station and the super collider were on the block at the same time, and the space station squeaked through, and the super collider did not manage to squeak through. And I really think that was a bad decision.
Well, around the same time, they canceled the supersonic transport with Boeing.
Yeah.
And I think if Boeing had been permitted to build that, we would have probably had much better and probably long-lasting routine supersonic travel, at least between large destinations. I think it would have been a lot better than what the Concorde turned out to be.
Yeah, I think the Boeing design would have turned out to be better than the Concorde. Hard to say whether that would have been commercially viable in the long run or not, but at any rate, that was another questionable decision on the part of the Congress.
Are we learning from past history and lessons, or are we, you know, seemingly doomed to keep repeating them in an endless loop
Groundhog Day? This is the Fabiana thing about whether you learn the lessons of history or whether you have to live them over again.
So,
I don't know. We seem to be doing a little of each.
Perpetually Groundhog Day,
yeah.
if you remember that
yeah.
Movie. We're almost at the halfway point, so this is a good point to pause. So listeners, we'll be back, and we'll certainly take more of your email questions. For those of you that can use the telephone on a Friday while you're at work, it is 1-866-687-7223. Much more to talk about with Dr. Kramer. Please don't go anywhere. Be right back.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And welcome back, everybody. This is part two of our Friday Space Show program. Our guest today, Dr. John Kramer. We're talking about his contribution to the book Starship Century, Toward the Grandest Horizon, Interstellar Travel, and Science, and lots of other issues. Dr. Kramer, I have quite a few guests, I mentioned this during the show, who really see wormholes as the way to advance us into interstellar travel. And surprisingly, a lot of people believe this is shelf-ready, to quote a term used for the stimulus a couple of years ago, is shelf-ready. And the only thing that stops us is the same thing we sort of alluded to earlier with more conventional space, and that is policy and politics and things of that nature. But that's really not correct about wormholes, is it?
No. we don't have any idea how to make a wormhole. I should say, however, that if Einstein had been correct, we would have them all over the place. Einstein and Rosen, the guys who first came up with the wormhole idea, were trying to, in a paper I published in about, I think, 1935, were trying to, they weren't worrying about interstellar travel, they were worrying about particles and where they come from. And they had the vision that particles like electrons are wormholes that have electric lines of flux threaded through them, so that the lines of flux go in on the negative particle and negative end of the wormhole that looks like an electron, and come out on the other end of the wormhole that looks that will look like a positron. And they hypothesized that fundamental particles are such topological structures in space with lines of flux and other forces threading through them. That turns out to be wrong. Later on, John Wheeler and some others calculated the mass of such an object, and it turns out to be on the order of a Planck mass, which is much heavier than an electron. So it's too bad that that electrons are not really wormholes, because if they were, maybe we could open them up and step through or something like that. But, the technology is very hard, because it requires, in a lot of the scenarios, and there's a lot of work going on and various ways of doing wormholes, and some of them look fairly promising, but almost all of them require what's called exotic matter, which is basically matter that has a negative mass. And we have never seen objects that have negative mass. People have looked for them, particle accelerators and so forth, and never seen any. There's something called the Casimir effect, where we can make a volume of space that has a slightly negative mass energy, but it's very small, almost unmeasurably small, and you'd need vast amounts of negative mass energy to stabilize a lot of the wormholes. So we're sort of out of business in that regard until we figure out some way of getting around this particular problem.
What is the theory supporting negative mass if there's no any kind of research evidence for it?
Nature tends to be symmetric, and everything else we know about electric charges and so forth, it can be positive or negative, and there's no particular reason why there couldn't be particles that have negative mass as well as positive mass. It's a little like magnetic monopoles. Maxwell's equation is all set up for having particles that have a positive and negative magnetic charges, but we've never seen any of those either. And so the theory is sort of sitting there waiting to deal with them if we ever find any.
Is science research into these areas going on at pretty much an equal pace around the world? Is the U.S. a leader? Have we lost our edge? How do you assess our position?
Well, the problem is that this is not very fashionable physics at the moment because nobody has any nifty new ideas about how to address the problem. And so there's a certain level. When particle accelerators get old, often people start using them to look for exotic particles. And so there's been a lot of work like that going on. That was the work I mentioned where people have used particle accelerators to look for objects coming out of collisions that have negative mass. Also look for magnetic monopoles coming out of such collisions and so forth. But this is not a hot topic of physics unless you found something. I guess some people call it measuring zero, that a lot of physics papers involve going to look for something that may or may not exist, and then you end up by writing a paper saying the search for X, where X is something that you looked for and didn't find. And you've measured zero to a higher precision, perhaps, but nothing else. I wanted to say one thing about wormholes, though. They have a property that's not widely appreciated and is sort of omitted in most of the science fiction that's written about them. And this is a thing called back reaction. Basically, the idea is that in the space around the entrance or the exit of a wormhole, the conservation laws have to hold. If you have a particle that has mass or charge or momentum or angular momentum that goes through a wormhole, that mass or charge or momentum or angular momentum is not allowed to disappear. The wormhole mouth itself has to take on the mass or charge or momentum or angular momentum that went through. And the other end of the wormhole where it comes out, the wormhole mouth has to take on the negative of the mass and charge and momentum and angular momentum that came through. And so you can't simply send a rocket ship through a wormhole without consequences. If the rocket ship had a mass of 1,000 tons or something like that, you'd have the wormhole's mass would have to change by an amount equal to E. Mass energy would have to change by an amount given by E equals mc squared. So it would have to change its mass by an enormous amount, and the exit of the wormhole would have to drop its mass by the same amount. So wormholes would be best used, if you had them, by sending equal amounts of these conserved quantities in both directions at the same time. If you send a space traveler through a wormhole, you might want to have a water pipe that sends an equal volume of equal mass of water back in the other direction in order to compensate for it and so forth. It's actually, if you consider a wormhole mouth as an object that's moving through space, you can use this to accelerate and decelerate and steer the thing. You could send momentum through sideways to deviate its trajectory and so forth. So if you had a traveling wormhole mouth projected through space, you could cause it to go where you wanted by sending amounts of momentum through it in various directions to cause it to deviate one way or another and point in the direction you want.
All I can say is when the Enterprise kept encountering wormholes, all of this was left out.
Yes. Yeah, I have not seen... I guess the only science fiction I recall where somebody did a good job of this was a time travel story in which in order to send three historians back to ancient Rome, they had to grab three Romans off the street that had the same mass as the time travelers and bring them into the present. And the three time travelers who went to ancient Rome had terrible, disastrous times and ended up as slaves. And the three Romans who came into modern society fitted right in and became billionaires. And so,
and probably the slave drivers in their companies.
Right.
Do you remember the name of that story?
No, I don't. I read it in Analog or Astounding when I was a teenager, probably. So, but. That's the only one I know where they seem to be a conservation law operating in practice. And I don't think it mentioned wormholes. I didn't think it was not that specific about the nature of the time machine. But.
Bob is in Denver, Colorado, with a question. And he says, is most of the advancement needed over time a function of money? For example, you mentioned balancing the budget. if we did not balance the budget and spent whatever was needed for science, could we cut the timeline down significantly?
Within limits, yeah. I mean, you can't spend an infinite amount of money on science, because, but you can spend a lot more than is presently being spent. The in particular, the killing of the superconducting supercollider probably set high-energy physics in the United States back by a generation. There's a sort of a lost generation of people who the survivors adapted by joining, rather late, joining the collaborations at the LHC and fitting themselves in. But since they came late to the banquet, they get the scraps, so to speak, and so they're not playing a major role in the high energy, cutting edge high energy physics going on today. The next the thing you have to understand is that in accelerators like the LHC, you're colliding lumpy things with lumpy things. A proton is made up of three quarks, and it's really the collisions of the quarks that are producing the interesting physics, not the collisions of the protons themselves. And these quarks are bouncing around in the particles, and so they don't have the collisions do not have a precise energy because of the motion of the quarks inside the protons. The alternative is to create a collider that collides more fundamental particles, namely protons and electrons and positrons, which are point-like particles, and some people have suggested colliding muons, which is another possibility. This is a sort of a high velocity rifle bullet as compared to a shotgun, as far as doing the physics is, and there are things that you could conceivably see with such a collider that you would not be able to see with the LHC. So the next particle accelerator, giant particle accelerator, if it actually gets built, will be probably an electron-positron collider or else a muon collider. And people are presently working on designing such things and worrying a little bit about where it would go if you were actually to build it, because there's a lot of competition, as you might imagine, for the siting of it. But nobody has reached the point where they're seriously in the position to make a proposal for putting it there. And what comes out of the LHC will determine a lot whether such a machine actually gets built. Because if the LHC sees something interesting and tantalizing, it provides a much better incentive for building the next machine than if the LHC simply goes around confirming various aspects of the standard model without showing any kinds of non-standard model physics.
What do you think such a collider would cost in today?
Well, the LHC, let's see, the SSC was probably would have cost, if they'd finished it, probably would have cost $10 billion in the current, in the a couple of, in the dollars of the 1990s and 2000s. So I guess it's probably like it would probably cost twice that much, maybe $20 billion, something like that.
Well, maybe one
of a lot less than the Treasury uses to they're using to buy bonds for quantitative easing at the moment every couple of weeks, but that's not.
Did you see that only 27% of Americans even know that something like QE is going on?
Well. that's not as surprising a result as one might think if one thinks about what most Americans know and don't know.
Yeah. Some of these space billionaires have spent significantly more than that on their rocket and space companies.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not
out of the question.
Out of the question that some very wealthy person who understands the need for this could step up to the plate. With the condition, of course, that it be built in his backyard. But
well, I mean, there's the cost of building the thing, and there's the cost of operating it, and the operating cost is there year after year after year after year. So I'm not sure, and it's not going to make a profit, so I'm not sure these billionaires that you're speaking of would be interested in doing something, which would be a continual drain on their resources like that.
Well, I don't know. Most of these guys haven't made a profit with their space stuff yet either.
So there is that. There's one thing I wanted to mention before we go too much further. The books I mentioned, Einstein's Bridge and Twister, were published by Avon, and you can still find used copies of them available, but they've gone out of print. And so last year I got the rights back and spent some time learning how to use Adobe InDesign in order to make them into e-books. And they're now available on e-books through an organization called BookView Cafe. So if anybody is interested in buying my books as e-books for $4.99 from BookView Cafe, do a search on BookView Cafe and Kramer, and you'll come up with it.
You actually sent me that link, so I'll put it in the archive. Okay. Summary of the program. Given that you are teaching science to non-professional scientists, I have heard when I interview a lot of people, including the Science Fiction Museum people in Seattle, that a lot of the people get really bored with science because the science fiction that they get to experience in the movies and television and on their smartphones is so much cooler. Like watching a NASA spacewalk is not very exciting, but watching a sci-fi movie with astronauts doing things in space can be pretty cool. So when you have these classes with sort of the general background students, is there a mixing up, at least from what you can see, of reality, science versus science fiction?
Well, my impression is, sometimes I ask for a show of hands of how many people have read a science fiction novel in the last year at the beginning of class, and the show of hands is dismayingly small, I guess I would say.
You should ask them how many.
A lot of the, particularly the people who are headed for med school, I think are so focused on that they're not doing much else in the way of recreational reading. So I'm not sure the people I'm teaching are the ones who would be bored because they watch too much, read too much science fiction. But I don't know. But the thing I would have to say is that there's a certain feeling from doing science which is hard to replicate anywhere else. I on a couple of occasions. As they say, science is what scientists do late at night, and often that's the case. That we have a small particle accelerator at the University of Washington, and sometimes I've been working on it till the wee hours, and sort of walked outside after giving up for the evening at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and looked up at the stars, and realized that I'm the only person on the planet and possibly in the universe that knows a particular thing because I just found it out in a laboratory. And there's a remarkable feeling associated with that, which is hard to get any other way I can think of.
I would think so. And how long does it last that you're the only person that knows that? I mean, because
not very long. I mean, the obvious the thing is that one tells one's colleagues and one publishes and so forth. But that sometimes the feeling lasts for a day or so.
You mentioned to me before the show that you're doing a tabletop quantum optics experiment.
Yeah.
Can you explain that and tell us about it?
Yeah, okay. Well, this involves some of the intricacies of quantum mechanics. In Newtonian mechanics, if you take a system and break it into two pieces, each of the pieces has a certain amount of mass and a certain amount of energy and a certain amount of momentum and a certain amount of angular momentum that have to add up to what you started with due to conservation laws. If you do the same thing with a quantum system, because of the uncertainty principle, the energy may not be well defined, the momentum may not be well defined, the angular momentum may not be well defined. And so you take these systems and you separate them, and each of the halves has an indefinite value of these quantities. So the question is, how is it that you avoid violating conservation of energy, conservation of momentum, conservation of angular momentum? And the answer is that the two pieces somehow remain in contact such that if you measure the momentum of one of the pieces, then you know that what the momentum of the other piece has to have in order for conservation laws to be in effect. And this is called quantum non-locality, and the wave functions that describe the two halves of the particle of the system are said to be entangled. So somehow nature has a way of retaining communication at a certain sense of the word communication between the two halves of the system, even if they're light years apart, through quantum non-locality. And this is something that's special to quantum mechanics, which is very different from classical physics. And Einstein first pointed this out as a criticism of quantum mechanics. He said quantum mechanics couldn't be right because it has this weird property that obviously is not something that anything can have. And then the 1970s and 80s, physicists went into the laboratory and measured it and found out that, yes, it does have that property, and it is indeed there. And Einstein was right that that it's weird, but he wasn't right that it's not there. the question is, is it possible for one to use this quantum entanglement to communicate between observers? Can you break the system into two halves and do something on one side of the table that has an effect on the other side of the table? And that's what we've been trying to measure. Which I call non-local communication, or test thereof. If you could do this, if you could use quantum non-locality to send messages, then you can send messages faster than instantaneously. You can send messages faster than the speed of light. You could even send messages backwards in time. Probably nature's not going to allow you to do all of those things, but maybe you can do some of them. And so the experiment that we've been doing involves a laser going into a special kind of crystal and producing a pair of entangled photons and that are momentum entangled. The momenta of the two photons in the transverse directions has to add up to zero because the incident beam had zero momentum in that direction. And so if you do something, if you cause one of these photons to behave like a particle, it forces the other photon to behave like a particle. If you force it to behave like a wave, then the other one has to behave like a wave too. And that constitutes a message that you could in principle send. The experiment involves detecting single photons of light individually, and we've been using a kind of detector called an avalanche photodiode to do this. And the trouble with avalanche photodiodes is that they're noisy. They count about 10,000 times a second with spontaneous avalanches, plus whatever they count in the way of real photons. And so this basically is not doable because of this noise level. And we tried cooling them down to liquid nitrogen temperatures to get rid of the problem. And it turns out that the noise goes down, but the avalanche threshold goes down at the same rate. So the spontaneous avalanche rate stays relatively constant, and cooling them doesn't help. So the next generation of the experiment has to be done with superconducting detectors called transition edge sensors. And I'm presently working on a collaboration, trying to get together a collaboration for taking the experiment to the next phase. The previous phase is over and done with and was unsuccessful.
So if you're going to send a message backwards in time, you have to know when and who and where to send it to, right?
No, let me explain how you might do this. You have this tabletop experiment. You have these two photons going to different regions of the table, and you make a measurement on one, and it affects what you see on the other side of the table, okay? Now, when you're driving down the street, you see these big orange spools of fiber optics that the cable companies and the telephone companies are laying in the trenches to provide communication. And typically, one of those big spools of fiber optics is 10 kilometers long. So if you could persuade the phone company to lend you one and roll it into your laboratory, then you could send one of the two photons that you're doing the measurements on through this spool of fiber optics before it comes out the other end. And it would take about 50 microseconds to come out the far end. So if you delay it by 50 microseconds by running it through the fiber, and then you do the measurement on it 50 microseconds later, this produces a result 50 microseconds earlier. So the sending would occur 50 microseconds after the receiving. And so you'd be sending a message backwards in time. what you could do that would do with that, I'm not sure. I asked some of my colleagues who know about what goes on in Wall Street about such things, and they said that Goldman Sachs went to the vast expense of moving all of their hardware, computing hardware, to the same site as the New York Stock Exchange uses in order to decrease the latency of their trades by a few microseconds. So if they could get a 50-microsecond advantage, they'd probably pay big bucks for it.
Fascinating. How do you get the ideas to do these kinds of research projects?
Well, this particular one came up in an interesting way. I was sent a paper by a guy who had been to a conference, and there was a graduate student from the Canadian university who suggested that a particular quantum optics experiment that had been done in Innsbruck by a woman named Birgit Dopfer might be done without the coincidence and used for demonstrating non-local communication. And he asked me what was wrong with this paper. And so I looked at it carefully and decided there probably wasn't anything wrong with it, except that the way the guy was thinking about changing it wouldn't work. But I could see a way of changing it so that it would work. And so I was going to an American Association for the Advancement of Science convention in San Diego on the subject of retrocausality and talking about my interpretation of quantum mechanics. And so as a sort of an add-on, I threw in this hypothetical thought experiment as a Gedanken experiment. You know, what's wrong with this? So it would seem that you could use it for non-local communication. I was expecting the experts in the audience to point out various problems that would keep you from doing this, I was rather surprised by the reaction. Everybody said, gee, that's a really interesting experiment. You ought to do it. And so thought about, you know, I was really thinking somebody else should do it, but I went back to the University of Washington and talked to one of my colleagues who does quantum optics about it, and he said, well, he said, down in the basement we have a laser laboratory that was provided by the National Science Foundation about 10 years ago, and there's a graduate student, there's a postdoc who's presently using it, but he has another job, and he's leaving in January, and nobody's going to be using this laser laboratory, and it has all the equipment you need to do your test, and it ought to be easy. Well, that turns out to be wrong because of the problem I mentioned with the avalanche photodiodes, but anyway, that's how I got sucked into doing this experiment, and I've been doing it for a while and reached the conclusion that the avalanche photodiodes are the showstopper, and you can't do it that way, but there may be a way in which you can do it. So,
You have another email question from Raymond in Tucson. He says, David, I'm at work, so I'm sending in an email. Doctor, do you believe that funding of some of these projects that you've talked about today, especially on the interstellar side, should be the responsibility of the public sector, or should we be getting more from the private sector?
The private sector funding is sort of spotty. I mean, it tends to be short-term and focused on getting a particular result on a particular time scale. So I think that if you're talking about long-range funding for basic research, then it pretty much has to be done in the public sector, because the time horizon for the private sector is much closer. The problem is that the National Science Foundation and the Department of Energy and NASA, who provide funding for basic research, have very limited budgets for doing this, because they have other programs that sometimes have higher priorities. And so there's a lot of competition for funds. And my impression is that over a period of time, the ratio of proposals made to proposals funded has been going up and up and up, that there are many, many, many more proposals made than funded these days, and there's a opportunity to fund a lot more. But I know that the libertarians of my acquaintance think that public funding for basic research is terrible, but I think it's the only way to do it. And if you want to expand the human knowledge, that it has to be done that way.
The private seems to want quicker results for sure.
Yes.
Which there may be no results, or actually a no result may be the result.
Yes, and sometimes that's good. The example was the Michelson-Morley experiment. They were trying to measure the velocity of the Earth through the universe by using an interferometer, and they got zero. And that was because the theory they were using is wrong, and what they really needed to understand was the special relativity, which wasn't available when they designed the experiment.
How often in a class, and this would include when you're teaching people who deliberately are looking for science majors and careers, do you come across a gifted genius type person?
Maybe one out of 5 years, there's somebody in a class who really seems to be in that sort of category. I mean, there's a lot of bright students. I mean, and there are people who are bright in different ways. I mean, they're very talented people in abstract thinking. They're very talented people in doing marvelous things with hardware and so forth. And we need all of them. In terms of having sort of bright in the level you're talking about, it's maybe one class out of 5 years. But in terms of having people who are bright enough to have successful careers in science, there's usually several of them in every class. So.
Interesting. So, do you track them and then? Can you say
sometimes they're interested in going into science, sometimes they're not. And there was a time a while back when it seemed like everybody, all the bright people who were coming along and had potential as being wonderful physicists were going into computer science instead. My impression is that computer science is now not such a glamour field as it once was, and physics is looking a lot more attractive. And in our physics department, our enrollment of undergraduate physics majors has been going up progressively year by year, there seem to be more and more people who are looking at physics as a way of getting the training they want for whatever it is they have in mind.
In terms of where we are with our space program, so in the remaining time, let me ask you for some of your opinions on it. Many people think because all we're able to do is go to the space station and actually on that we're buying rides with the Russians for lots and lots of money, that our program is pretty much dysfunctional, and many look at the new government rocket, the SLS, as being something that will never be completed due to its cost, and then they have doubts on this asteroid redirect mission that NASA has been proposing lately. How do you see our NASA space program, our civil space program? What do you think of it?
Well, okay, I think that NASA badly needs to get away from focusing exclusively on large rockets and that kind of propulsion. There's an organization, a NASA organization that canceled and then has been reconstituted, called NIAC, and I'm on the external council of NIAC, and every two or three times a year I go in here and go to meetings of NIAC, which listen to sort of far out ideas about things having to do with space. I just got back from one a couple of weeks ago that was held in Washington D.C., and I think that's a very valuable activity for. By looking at innovations, and NASA has a department where innovations are being emphasized and being pushed, and I think that's a very good development. As far as they've been jerked around a little bit by the federal government. George Bush's moon project got canceled, and now the asteroid. I think the asteroid project is a valuable one, and I think it should be encouraged. But I don't have a very good feeling for the long-term prospects of NASA because it depends so much on the underlying politics of the funding, and they need lots of money, and they need a consistent. I mean, they're doing things that have long time scales, and yet they're dealing with budget cycles that have very short time scales, and it's basically a basic incompatibility that's hard to deal with.
That's for sure. But, you know, the asteroid mission is dependent upon the rocket SLS. I was just at the AIAA meeting in San Diego, and they gave a press conference to us about that mission and spoke at a keynote. And a lot of questions came in on this, and they are, if you can believe them, and, I mean, you know, you don't know what's the spin and what's not, but they're 100% dependent on SLS for that mission. And SLS is, you know, a challenge, to say the least, with cost as well as low flight rates and everything else. So the likelihood of this to happen is probably not very high. In fact, Leonard David of Space.com and Space News said, if you fail on this mission, are you going to take down and end human spaceflight in the country forever, coming from NASA? Because you seem to be putting all your eggs in this, which means all your eggs on the big rocket. And, of course, they don't see failure, but
yeah, to others. On the other hand, I'm not sure they have an alternative, because if you don't put your resources behind a particular, if you try to spread your resources among several projects rather than just one, then you may starve them all to death. And so
NASA remains a challenge from a lot of people's perspectives.
Indeed.
Science is also funded on this one-year kind of budget process. And, of course, over the past several years, we don't even get budgets. We get continuing resolutions.
Right.
So most science projects, I would think, are long-term as well. So science faces the same dilemma that NASA does, right?
Probably not quite at the same level, because it's easy to break it up into littler pieces because you don't have giant hunking rockets to buy in general. But certain areas of science are more impacted than others. I mean, in certain areas, the impact is because you have a big expensive project and you have to keep funding it. In other areas, it's because there are a lot of people who are competing for the same money, and so it's sort of you're sort of in the shark tank or the piranha tank, and everybody's chewing on everybody else. I'm involved in a experiment at Brookhaven National Laboratory called the STAR Collaboration. We have a big detector and a collider that collides gold on gold and uranium on uranium and makes collisions that look something like the first microsecond of the Big Bang. The particles have head-on collisions. Thousands of particles come out of each collision. We track them with this big detector and try to put Humpty Dumpty back together again and figure out what happened. And that has been going on for 10 years and shows, and as far as I know, is going to go on for at least a few more years and requires significant funding. So it's possible to do sort of 10-year timescale projects under the present funding situation. There are always adventures and slips and problems and canceled runs and one thing or another, but we seem to be able to get away with it.
This is probably your last question of the program, as we're near the end of it. But Bill sent in an email from Boston, and he says, "I too am at work, so I'm using email. David had another contributor to the Starship Century book on his show earlier this week, Dr. Paul Davies.
Yes.
Dr. Davies was asked about the possibility of extraterrestrial life, not just in the solar system, but having visited Earth at one time. What are your thoughts on extraterrestrial life?"
I think there's certainly likely to be life out there somewhere. Whether it's anywhere very close and whether it resembles ours is another matter. There are theories about life having come from outside the solar system and or perhaps from Mars and populated the Earth. I don't think that's well established, and I don't think it completely matters. If life starts, it doesn't matter a whole lot whether it started here or it started someplace else. It clearly started, and once there's what they call in mathematics an existence theorem. We know that life exists in at least one instance, and therefore it seems likely it's going to exist in other instances. But whether there are whether there's life on Earth-like planets orbiting other stars is an interesting question. We don't have any way of getting at that right now, but there are possibilities using interferometry and so forth of finding signals like oxygen in the atmosphere and so forth and other star systems that would be very interesting to know more about.
Well, that would suggest that life was somewhat similar to ours, but people still are hoping to find silicon-based life, right? So that would be very different.
There are perhaps lots of ways of making life. As I said, that we know of one way. That's there's no guarantee at all that that's the unique way of doing it, and there might be other quite different ways of doing it.
Dr. Davies had mentioned that the probabilities, though small, might be that life had visited Earth 100 million years ago, and there's now very little, if any, trace left of it. Is that even a possibility in your concepts?
By visited, you mean some extraterrestrials landing here or something?
Something.
A wandering microbe that happened to hit going through the atmosphere.
I think he was talking, this was a wild speculation, of course, but that if some kind of advanced life had visited Earth 100 million years ago or longer, would there be any evidence of that left today? And he seemed to indicate there'd be very little and it would be hard to find, but you couldn't possibly rule it out completely.
Yeah, the question is what they leave behind and whether it's qualitatively different from what from other things. I think it would be very hard to make any kind of a case. If that happened that long ago, it would be very hard to make any kind of case for it. We don't even know for sure whether Vikings landed in North America well before Columbus and so forth. I guess there's some runes on one thing or another in various places, but that's on the order of a few hundred years. If you're talking in billions of years, I think that it's anybody's guess.
We are at the end of the program. Do you have any concluding thoughts you'd like to share with us today?
Well, I was just wanting to say in connection with what's in my Starship Century book that there is, if given wormholes, there are ways of reaching the stars in a few weeks or a few years, and if wormholes are possible, this may be our path to the stars, and I would encourage people to look at that chapter and see how it might be done. Thank you.
Okay. I want to thank you very much for being a guest on the show today. It's been a real pleasure, and I hope we can repeat it down the road and stay in tune with some of your research.
Okay, great.
Thank you very much. Listeners, that's it. Back on Sunday with another Space Show program. Everybody have a great weekend. Goodbye from the Space Show.